Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Sawadee kap. Hello and welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha. Today is our Pali Canon and English study group, and we're in volume 12, which is titled Lowly Arts. We're going to be studying chapters 21 through 30 today. So I'd like to welcome you, whether you're joining for the first time or you've been joining regularly. We're going to read the words of the Buddha in our study group here, and then I'll share some teachings on that and then open up to any and all questions that you guys have. This is part of a year and a half program where we gradually go through volumes 2 through 13 of this book series titled The Words of the Buddha, The Path to Enlightenment, Revealing the Hidden. It starts with this book, Volume 1, which is a great foundational book to really help you establish a nice foundation in the path to enlightenment and all the teachings from the Buddha based in the original words of the Buddha. But then, as you learn in the various programs we have that are foundational, you can move into this program where you can learn with the original words of the Buddha to fill in the framework or build up your foundation even further, where you'll understand the path to enlightenment, to move the mind to this peaceful, calm, serene and content mind with joy, where you eliminate all discontent feelings. That's what the enlightened mind is, where you no longer experience any anger, sadness, frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, stress, anxiety, loneliness, boredom, shyness, resentment, jealousy, even the slightest displeasure is eliminated from the enlightened mind. You'll notice that when you eradicate the pollutions of the mind, that you're experiencing focus, concentration, clarity, and deep memory. You'll not even be in a bad mood anymore. Your personal and professional relationships will really blossom. And you do that through learning, reflecting, that means independently verifying the teachings, and practicing those teachings, integrating them into your life in order to purify the mind and cleanse the mind of any pollutions that are being experienced as a result of being in the unenlightened state. The Buddha discovered these 10 individual pollutions that can be eradicated from the mind through training of the mind. And now, as you do so, you'll notice that the peace and the joy comes into the mind, and then the discontent feelings gradually diminish all the way to the point where they're completely extinguished. So again, welcome to all of you guys. I'm going to switch over to the chapters that we're going to be studying today, which again is volume 12, chapters 21 through 30. And you can acquire this book series through our website, which is buddhadailywisdom.com. If you go there, you'll be able to download the books for free. You can also take those and go print them, those files that you download, or you can order copies from Amazon if you have access to Amazon in your country. And here at the temple where I teach in Chiang Mai, Thailand, we have versions of this too, where you can essentially just reimburse us for our printing costs and then acquire a printed version of the individual books. So again, welcome to you. And as we go, you're welcome to ask any and all questions by putting that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions, and I'll be able to see those questions and answer them for you. So this first chapter, 21, that we're going to be studying today, it's titled Six Unsurpassed Things. Monks, there are these six unsurpassed things. What six? One, the unsurpassed sight. Two, the unsurpassed hearing. Three, the unsurpassed gain. Four, the unsurpassed training. Five, the unsurpassed service. And six, the unsurpassed recollection, or recalls and remembers. One, and what, monks, is the unsurpassed sight? Here, someone hopes to see the elephant gem, the horse gem, the jewel gem, or to see various sights. Or else they go to see an ascetic or Brahmin of wrong views, of wrong practice. There is this seeing. This I do not deny. But this seeing is low, common, worldly, not honorable, and unbeneficial. It does not lead to freedom from strong feelings, elimination, peace, direct knowledge, experience, enlightenment, and nibbana. When, however, one of settled confidence, of settled determination, dedicated, full of confidence, goes to see the Tathagata or a disciple of the Tathagata, this unsurpassed sight is for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and grief, for the passing away of pain and sadness, for the achievement of the method to attain enlightenment, for the realization of nibbana, enlightenment. This is called the unsurpassed sight. Such is the unsurpassed sight. Okay, so I'm going to stop here because these other paragraphs are very similar to what we're reading here in this first one. What the Buddha is talking about here is the unsurpassed sight. He's talking about that when you can see the path to enlightenment and you can understand it and you have confidence and you're determined and you're dedicated towards the development of that through visiting him or one of his students, this is the unsurpassed sight. This is where you can see clearly the natural laws of existence and you can then purify your mind and train it to overcome any discontent feelings like sorrow and grief. And you can get to this enlightened mental state where the mind is no longer experiencing any discontent feelings. So that's the unsurpassed sight. The Buddha is saying that this is very beneficial for the mind. And you can see this to be true for yourself. If you've studied the teachings of the Buddha to any certain degree, you can see that they're very detailed, they're very clear and concise. You can understand them, you can reflect on them to independently verify them, and you can practice them and see the results as your mind becomes more and more enlightened. Well, he's comparing that to someone who goes and sees a particular gem, right? Like we might compare this to maybe like the Hope Diamond or some famous ruby or a pearl or some emerald or sapphire or something like this. Nowadays, people might think, oh, wow, this is so beautiful to see. Or maybe some beautiful landscape or some tourist site or something like that. And the Buddha is saying, okay, there's that type of sight. And then there's even going to see an ascetic or Brahmin who doesn't understand the path to enlightenment and doesn't understand how to get to enlightenment. There's those types of sight. But the Buddha is saying out of those types of sight that they're essentially low or common, worldly, not honorable and unbeneficial because it doesn't lead to enlightenment. It doesn't lead to peace and the elimination of discontent feelings. So there's these two different types of sight, just kind of seeing worldly possessions like some beautiful gem or going to see a particular person who doesn't understand the path to enlightenment, an ascetic or Brahmin. The Buddha is saying, you know, this isn't going to lead to improvement to the condition of your mind in the condition of your life. But it's through visiting him and his disciples that that is what would be considered the unsurpassed sight. And then he has the same thing here when he talks about the unsurpassed hearing. He talks about certain things that you could hear or going to visit a certain teacher of wrong view, of wrong practice. He's saying those things are low, common, worldly, not honorable, and unbeneficial because it doesn't lead to enlightenment. But then if you visit with him or his students that are sharing these teachings that lead to enlightenment, this is the unsurpassed hearing, that you're visiting them and you're being able to hear the teachings to be able to purify your mind and get to enlightenment. He talks about the same thing around gain, any kind of gain in terms of wealth or monetary gain or anything like that. And then he says, okay, you know, that's kind of unbeneficial, but having this gain of understanding the teachings that it takes to get to enlightenment, this is the unsurpassed gain. Because the wisdom that it takes to get to enlightenment, you'll never forget this wisdom. And this is the best thing you could ever do for your life, is acquire the wisdom that it takes to be able to get to enlightenment. And then there's the unsurpassed training, where he's talking about different types of training that went on at that time. And then, of course, training under an individual who doesn't understand the path to enlightenment, an ascetic or Brahmin. The Buddha is saying all of that is unbeneficial because it doesn't lead to enlightenment. But studying with him and the students that he's taught, this is the way that leads to the enlightened mental state, because you're training in the wisdom, the moral conduct, the mental discipline. This is what's going to help you overcome the discontentedness. And then there's the unsurpassed service, where the Buddha is talking about serving a particular person or serving an individual who is an ascetic or Brahmin who doesn't understand the path to enlightenment. He's saying this is unhonorable or unbeneficial. But serving the Tathagata or a disciple of the Tathagata, you're now coming in contact with an individual who knows the teachings that it takes to actually get to enlightenment, and now you can gain that wisdom for yourself. So the Buddha is saying this is the unsurpassed service, because essentially you're coming in proximity to an individual or multiple individuals who can help you and guide you on the path to enlightenment. And then finally, he talks about the unsurpassed recollection, or something that you recall, or your memory. And here he's talking about something that you might actually recollect, and saying, okay, if you recollect the gain of a son, of a wife, or any kind of wealth, or you recollect any various kinds of times that you've spent time with a teacher who doesn't understand the path to enlightenment, the Buddha is saying this is unbeneficial because it doesn't lead to the elimination of strong feelings or enlightenment. But it's when you study with him and or someone who's sharing his teachings that this is actually the unsurpassed way of progressing in the world, is that you're remembering the teachings, so this unsurpassed memory, to be able to retain the teachings and soak those into the mind so that now you can actually practice them. So this is chapter 21, where the Buddha goes through these six unsurpassed things: unsurpassed sight, hearing, gain, training, service, and recollection, all relating it to learning and developing on the path to enlightenment. That is the unsurpassed way to progress in the world, progress with your joy and your peace, progress in developing your life and your life practice, is by learning and practicing. This is highly beneficial for the mind. And the Buddha understands that because he knows he's gotten to enlightenment, and it's his teachings that are going to guide someone else to get to that same mental state. And if you understand the peace and the joy that is experienced in the enlightened mental state, there's nothing that is better than that, being able to eliminate all these discontent feelings and living life in this permanent mental state of the enlightened mind. So let me know what questions you guys have here. You can put those into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand and ask any questions that you like. Okay, it looks like Mayuli has a question here. When the Buddha mentioned recollection, does he mean memories from previous lives as well? In this situation, what he's sharing is the recollection that is unsurpassed is memorizing the teachings and understanding the teachings, because you would need to do that, particularly during his lifetime, because there wasn't any books or videos or podcasts or audio books or things like this that you would need to listen to him speak, and then you would need to memorize what it is that he shared, and that's how you would be able to then practice the teachings. So memorizing the teachings is very important. Nowadays, you don't need to memorize them word for word, but you do need to memorize the meaning in the understanding of the individual teachings, and that is the unsurpassed memory. But anything else that you remember, it's not that you can't remember those things or you shouldn't remember those things, it's just that those things aren't going to lead to enlightenment. So you're going to see here in a moment, in a particular chapter, where he does talk about being beneficial to remember your past lives. But not everybody's going to remember their past lives as part of getting to enlightenment, but some people do, and it's not uncommon for that to occur. But the recollection here, the unsurpassed recollection, is to understand the teachings and recall them and deeply soak them into the mind. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions anywhere. So let's move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 22. This one is titled Demonstration of Confidence in One Endowed with Confidence. Here the Buddha is going to teach you how to develop confidence in the teachings, because you're going to need this in order to eradicate the fetter of doubt. That doubt, the second fetter, is hindering the mind from being able to get to enlightenment, where you doubt the Buddha, his teachings, the community, your teacher, or your own ability to get to enlightenment. So you're going to need to build confidence in order to overcome this doubt to be able to make your way on the path to enlightenment. And the way that you do that is through learning and investigating the teachings. But the Buddha here is going to give you some very detailed teachings about how to overcome doubt. This is the time for it, fortunate one. This is the time for it. Fortunate one, the perfectly enlightened one should explain the demonstrations of confidence. Now I will find out whether or not this monk exhibits the demonstrations of confidence. Then listen, Subhuti, and attend closely. I will speak. Here, Subhuti, a monk, is virtuous, practicing moral conduct. He resides restrained by the training guidelines, possessed of good conduct and wise decision-making, seeing danger in the slightest faults. Having undertaken the training guidelines, he trains in them. This is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 2. Again, a monk has learned much, remembers what he has learned, and accumulates what he has learned. Those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, which proclaim the perfectly complete and pure spiritual life, such teachings as these he has learned much of, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 3. Again, a monk has wholesome friends, wholesome companions, and wholesome comrades. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 4. Again, a monk is easy to correct and possesses qualities that make him easy to correct. He is patient and perceives instruction respectfully. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 5. Again, a monk is skillful and diligent in attending to the diverse chores that are to be done for his fellow monks. He possesses sound ability to make decisions about them in order to carry them out and arrange them properly. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 6. Again, a monk adores the teachings and is pleasing in his statements, filled with significant joy in regard to the teachings and discipline. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. Again, a monk adores the teachings and is pleasing in his statements, filled with significant joy in regard to the teachings and discipline. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 7. Again, a monk has aroused energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. He is strong, firm in effort, not casting off the duty of cultivating wholesome qualities. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 8. Again, a monk gains at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and are peaceful dwellings in this very life. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 9. Again, a monk recollects, recalls, remembers his countless past lives, that is, one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world dissolution, many eons of world evolution, many eons of world dissolution and world evolution. Thus, there I was, so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan. Passing away from there, I was reborn elsewhere, and there too I was so named of such a clan. With such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan. Passing away from there, I was reborn here. Thus he recollects, recalls, remembers his countless past lives with their aspects and details. This, too, is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 10. Again, with the divine eye, or third eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, a monk sees beings passing away and being reborn, unwholesome and wholesome, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and he understands how beings fare in accordance with their karma. Thus, these beings who engaged in misconduct by body, speech, and mind, who abusively criticized the noble ones, held wrong view and undertook unwholesome karma based on wrong view, with the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the low world, in hell. But these beings who engaged in wholesome conduct by body, speech, and mind, who did not abusively criticize the noble ones, who held right view and undertook wholesome kamma based on right view, with the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, third eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and being reborn, unwholesome and wholesome, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and he understands how beings fare in accordance with their karma. This too is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. 11. Again, with the destruction of the taints, a monk has realized for himself, with direct knowledge in this very life, the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, and having entered upon it, he resides in it. This too is a demonstration of confidence in one endowed with confidence. So here the Buddha is providing 11 things that one can experience in order to develop their confidence. I won't have time to go through all 11, but I'll go through a few of them here, and then you can ask questions about any of them that you would like. This first one, he's talking about moral conduct. He's talking about how if you're practicing the moral conduct, this is going to allow you to build confidence, because as you learn the moral conduct, as you reflect on it and independently verify and see that it's true, and then you practice it, you're shutting down the harm that you're causing to other beings. Because by you causing harm through your intention, speech, actions, your livelihood, this harm is all coming back to you. But as you gain the wisdom of the moral conduct on the natural law of karma, and you implement that, and you see that you're not causing harm and less harm is coming back to you, as you purify your mind can be at ease because you know you're not causing harm to other beings, where you can walk down the street without fear, you can fall asleep at night not being conflicted and worrying about what you said to one person versus another, because you know that you're practicing this good wholesome moral conduct and nothing is going to come back to you that is wholesome. So when you go an extended period of time of practicing the moral conduct that the Buddha teaches, you will be shutting down any kind of harm that you're causing other beings, so therefore less and less harm is coming back to you, until eventually you get to the point where people are just treating you very wonderful, right? Because you're treating everyone else wonderful. So here, this is going to help you to build confidence in the teachings and your ability to attain enlightenment if you're able to learn and practice the moral conduct. And this is typically where the Buddha would start his students from the very beginning of the path to enlightenment, because as long as you're doing harmful things in the world, this harm is going to keep coming back to you. So you'd like to shut that down as soon as possible through gaining the wisdom of right speech, right action, and right livelihood through the Eightfold Path. And then included into that being the five precepts. And there's other teachings on moral conduct as well that you can learn about. And this is going to only help you in your growth and development and developing your life practice and experiencing peace and joy. Because if you were out there being harsh and aggressive and hostile and bitter to people, people are going to be that way with you. And it would be very challenging for you to ever get to a peaceful and joyful mind and a peaceful and joyful life if people are constantly attacking you either verbally or physically due to the things that you're choosing to do. So you can shut down all those harmful things that you're doing, and then you'll experience more and more wholesome results coming back to you. The Buddha goes through many different things here, talking about different aspects of your practice. This number four here, he's talking about how a student is easy to correct and they're easy to take guidance and they patiently receive instruction from a teacher and they do that respectfully. Sometimes if a student doesn't have confidence, if they have doubt about the teacher, they will have ego and they'll be conceited and boastful and puffed up with those types of qualities. And now when they're with a teacher, they might still come to talk to a teacher, they might still come to a temple and things like this, but in reality, they've got a whole lot of ego in there. They haven't really chosen to be a student yet. And now when they're talking or they're asking questions, they're not really truly asking questions. They're really trying to show other people what they learned and what they think that they know, and they're not really there to truly learn and understand from a teacher. But someone who has confidence and they understand that these teachings are improving their life and their mind, they would patiently receive instruction respectfully because they have confidence in the teachings and they're there to get help from an actual teacher. We could go through all of these. Like I mentioned, there's many different ones here that the Buddha is rightfully teaching that are really helpful. He even talks about recollecting your past lives. If you recollect your past lives, surely that's going to develop confidence in your mind, because you'll know with 100% certainty that the cycle of rebirth is true. But ultimately, what he gets to is this very last one, where he talks about attaining enlightenment. Whereas if you attain enlightenment, for sure you're going to have confidence, because you have seen that the mind has moved closer and closer to this peace and joy. You'll have nothing but confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, because you will have seen that you went from being angry and frustrated and agitated and all those other discontent feelings to the peace and joy of the enlightened mental state. And you'll eventually get to the point where you have nothing but confidence in the teachings of the Buddha. And you'll have that long before you get to enlightenment. But getting to enlightenment is the ultimate confidence booster, because you'll know that it's been 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you haven't experienced any discontentedness whatsoever. And that will be the ultimate thing that helps you to develop confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, because they led exactly where he said they did. So let me know if you guys have any questions on this chapter. This is chapter 22, Demonstration of Confidence and One Endowed with Confidence. Okay, Mayuli's having a question here. When having joy, learning, reflecting, absorbing, and practicing the teachings, is this joy the same joy as being in the jhanas, that unconditional joy? If your joy because of something, this is still conditional happiness. It's not yet unconditional joy. So if you're joyful because of learning, or you're joyful because of reflecting, that means if you're not learning, you would not be joyful, right? That's still conditional happiness. So when I talk about joy, I talk about it as an unconditioned mental state versus a feeling, because feelings, they arise, they change, and they fade away. That's what a conditional feeling is. The conditional happiness, it arises, changes, and fades away. It's impermanent or temporary. But these unconditioned mental qualities of enlightenment, the peace, calm, serenity, contentedness, and joy, they don't arise, they don't change, and they don't fade away. They're just always there. They're persistent. So you'll need to take a look at your mind and see, are these feelings that are arising, changing, and fading away, or is this just a mental state where the mind is just joyful because it's joyful, not for any particular reason at all? That's what unconditioned joy is, that there's no particular reason why the mind's joyful. It's just joyful. That's unconditioned joy. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions anywhere. So let's move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 23. Here, this one is titled The Perfectly Enlightened One Taught Monks to Eat at a Single Session. On one occasion, the perfectly enlightened one taught the monks the benefits of eating in a single session, that one will be free from illness and affliction, and will enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable residing. Bahalat, I don't know if I'm pronouncing the student's name right, so I'll just refer to him as student. Student told the perfectly enlightened one that he was not willing to do so. Then the perfectly enlightened one agreed to allow the student to keep the food for the next meal. Again, the student told the perfectly enlightened one he was not willing to do that either. Then the venerable student did not present himself to the perfectly enlightened one for a whole 3 month period, until the robe making period, where the monk said that to student that his actions was inappropriate. Student then went to see the perfectly enlightened one. Venerable sir, a wrongdoing overcame me, in that, like an unwise person, confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by the perfectly enlightened one, when the community of monks was undertaking the training, I declared my refusal to observe your teaching. Venerable sir, may the perfectly enlightened one forgive my wrongdoing, seen as such for the sake of restraint in the future. Surely, student, a wrongdoing overcame you, in that, like an unwise person, confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by me, when the community of monks was undertaking the training, you declared your refusal to practice this teaching. What do you think, student? Suppose a monk here were one liberated in both ways, and I told him, come, monk, be a plank for me across the mud. Would he walk across himself, or would he dispose his body otherwise, or would he say no? No, venerable sir. What do you think, student? Suppose a monk here were one liberated by wisdom, a body witness, one attained to view, one liberated by confidence, a teachings follower, a confidence follower. And I told him, come, monk, be a plank for me across the mud. Would he walk across himself, or would he dispose his body otherwise, or would he say no? No, venerable sir. What do you think, student? Were you on that occasion one liberated in both ways, or one liberated by wisdom, or a body witness, or one attained to view, or one liberated by confidence, or a teachings follower, or a confidence follower? No, venerable sir. Student, on that occasion, were you not empty, unwise, and mistaken? Yes, venerable sir. Venerable sir, a wrongdoing came to me, in that like an unwise person, confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by the perfectly enlightened one, when the community of monks were undertaking the training, I declared my refusal to practice this teaching. Venerable sir, may the perfectly enlightened one forgive my wrongdoing, seen as such for the sake of restraint in the future. Surely, student, a wrongdoing overcame you, in that like an unwise person, confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by me, when the community of monks was undertaking the training, you declared your refusal to practice this teaching. But since you see your wrongdoing as such, and make apologies in accordance with the teachings, we understand you, for it is growth in the noble one's discipline when one sees one's wrongdoing as such and makes apologies in accordance with the teachings by undertaking restraint for the future. Okay, so here, this is a situation where the Buddha was teaching to eat just one meal a day. And he taught this during his lifetime to the ordained practitioners because it helped them to overcome sensual desire. You're not required to eat just one meal a day in order to get to enlightenment, but it is one particular training that some ordained practitioners choose to practice. And nowadays, they actually eat two meals a day because some people say that the caloric value or the calories that existed in a particular food during the lifetime of the Buddha has been reduced to this point, where now our environment is not as healthy as it was 2,500 years ago. So like the calories that you acquire from a broccoli, for example, during the lifetime of a Buddha was much higher than the calories today. So you kind of need a bit more food. But the reason why the Buddha taught to eat just one meal a day is that it takes the mind away from making decisions about when to eat and eating based in emotion. That oftentimes when your mind has craving, desire, attachment, if you feel angry or sad or frustrated, you might turn to food, which there's a craving there to maybe have a piece of chocolate cake or ice cream or something like this as a way to get the mind back to something that feels somewhat comfortable. So if you're experiencing painful feelings like anger, sadness, or frustration, you might turn to some kind of food to get those conditioned pleasant feelings. And this is actually making the problem go further, that it's the craving for those pleasant feelings that is causing the mind to go up and down and up and down. If you continue to eat based in emotion, you're not actually eliminating the craving that is causing the painful feelings. You're actually supporting the craving and indulging in that by going to the food to try to get those pleasant feelings, rather than eliminating the craving to get to the peace and the joy. So the Buddha taught to eat in a single session. And for an ordained practitioner who's maybe just reading books and meditating and sitting around and talking, this is very possible. And also with the higher caloric value that was potentially occurring at the time of the Buddha, this is very possible. But for a household practitioner, or nowadays, ordained practitioners live a more active lifestyle than perhaps they did during the lifetime of the Buddha. They didn't really move around too much during the lifetime of the Buddha. That more food is actually needed in order to sustain the health of the body. You're going to need to get to the point where you eat in moderation and you're not eating based in emotion, and that you see food as something that nourishes the physical body, not something to please the tongue and please the mind, because that's what the mind will typically do in the unenlightened state, is it'll see food as something to please the tongue and please the mind. So you'll have certain cravings about food and you'll only eat the foods that you find to be enjoyable, and you will push away away any foods that you dislike. But in order to get to enlightenment, you're going to need to eliminate that central desire. You're going to need to be able to train your mind to be able to eat any and all foods and be able to see food as just something to nourish the body. That if you see food as something to please the tongue and please the mind, you'll continue to go after those foods that the mind finds pleasing. But you would like to be able to put the mind in the situation that it doesn't particularly care for to train it to be comfortable, because good tasting food is not permanent. You're not going to be able to permanently be able to eat food that tastes good. So if you allow the craving for good tasting food to exist in the mind, then that means when you eat good food, you'll be happy. But when you eat food that you find to be displeasing, you'll be sad or frustrated or angry. So what you do is you train your mind to be able to eat in moderation, to not eat based on emotion, and then to eat all foods, that you don't push away any particular foods. And one of the ways to do that is, yes, to eat a single meal a day, but also you can eat food that other people have selected for you. So like the ordained practitioners, they will walk down the street and just accept whatever food is given to them. And this helps them to not make choices about their food. And as a household practitioner, you can actually accomplish the same thing. There are certain meal plans that you can sign up for in various countries that just deliver food to you and you don't make any choices. It's just a set menu. This would be a great way to train the mind to eliminate central desire. Also, when you go to restaurants and things like this, instead of going through the menu and finding that exact dish that you think is going to be perfect for you, you could just ask the food server or somebody around, you know, what do you recommend that someone would eat here at this restaurant? And then whatever they suggest, just order that. Even if it's something you'll never ever eat in the past, like maybe they suggest that you order some eggplant and you never eat eggplants. Well, okay, just go with it, right? Just accept whatever they say. Or if you're sitting at a table with people and somebody orders a dish, just say, okay, I'll take what they have, right? And you don't make any choices. This takes the mind out of it from having to make a decision and basing its decisions and craving. And you can do this for a period of time, maybe 6 months or a year, until you get to the point where you can eat any and all foods. So as the Buddha is introducing this, this student blatantly refuses to practice this. And of course, a teacher, particularly a fully perfectly enlightened Buddha, isn't attached to their student practicing any particular teaching. The teachings that are being shared are there for the students to be able to help them and guide them. If a student refuses to practice a teaching, okay, it's affecting them. It's not affecting the teacher. So you can see here the Buddha wasn't angry or upset or frustrated, but it sounds like this student was somewhat rude where he blatantly spoke out in front of the group and saying, I'm not going to practice that teaching. And then the Buddha's like, all right, no problem. Then you can eat this particular food next time. And he's like, I'm not going to do that either, right? Maybe he was kind of arrogant or boastful or disgruntled. And then he went away from the Buddha for 3 months and didn't come talk to the Buddha and get any more training or teaching or guidance. So it was the other monks that went to that student and said, hey, this was kind of inappropriate the way that you handled this situation. So once the student understood that, he then came back to the Buddha and apologized to the Buddha for what he had done. And you can see that a Buddha loves all beings unconditionally. Even though this student did this, the Buddha still accepted him with open arms, right? He's not going to turn away a student just because he's struggling on the path to enlightenment. It's common for a student to struggle on the path to enlightenment. They're going to have confusion, or they're going to have certain pollutions that arise, and they might be disrespectful to a teacher or something like this. But in saying an apology of understanding where they've made a mistake or something like this, this is a great way for somebody to improve their relationship with their teacher. That if they've been disrespectful or they've been unkind or impolite, they can always apologize. And then if the teacher doesn't have craving, desire, attachment, they would be able to put this to the side and just move forward. There would be no issues whatsoever. And that's what the Buddha did here. And as he's doing this, he's kind of counseling the student. And he's helping the student understand, like, hey, you're going to struggle on the path to enlightenment, and you're not necessarily going to follow every single thing that I say and everything that I recommend. And he gives him an example here. He explains how, okay, if there's somebody who's enlightened, this is what he says here, essentially when he says somebody liberated, he's saying, okay, if somebody is liberated, and I said to them, come and lay down across this mud and let me walk across your body. This person's enlightened. And if the Buddha said this to them, the Buddha is saying, okay, would this enlightened being actually lay down on the mud and let me walk across their body? And the student says, no, of course not. They wouldn't let you do that. Well, the Buddha is not going to ask for a student to do that. So the Buddha is essentially saying, I'm not going to ask you something and I'm not going to suggest something for you in my teachings that would be unwise. I'm only going to provide you teachings and guidance that would be wise and help you get to enlightenment. I'm not going to ask you to lay down across the mud puddle and let me walk across your body. I'm not even going to ask you that. But if I did, and even if you were enlightened, you still wouldn't do it, even though I said or I asked you to do it. And the student says, yeah, that's true. Right? And then he asked him again, and he replied again. So then the Buddha says, okay, on that situation where you refused to practice this teaching, were you enlightened at that time? And the student's like, no, I wasn't enlightened at that time. So of course, this student is now going to make mistakes. They're going to have difficulties and struggles on the path to enlightenment because they weren't enlightened. Their pollutions of mind are going to come up in their mind and make it such that they make unwise decisions. And that's what the Buddha is saying here, is that you were making unwise decisions in that situation because you're unenlightened. And he understands that as an unenlightened being, you're going to make unwise decisions. If the Buddha only ever taught people who were wise, he would only be teaching enlightened beings. Right? So he's going to be teaching students who are unwise, and they're going to sometimes say or do things that are unwise. And the Buddha understands this, and he has compassion for them, concern for their misfortune. And he has loving kindness, which is a genuine interest in seeing them be well. And then since this individual has understood his mistake and apologized for that, the Buddha says, okay, you've made progress now. You've acknowledged the situation where you've been mistaken, and now you've grown in developing more wisdom that this is unwise for you to do this kind of thing in the future. So now it's going to help this person to grow and develop on the path to enlightenment. And the Buddha essentially ends up praising this person for having done so. So this is how a Buddha would end up teaching their students, is they wouldn't be angry or disgruntled with them when they're making mistakes and they're being disrespectful occasionally. They're going to guide them and teach them and accept them with open arms, particularly when they see their wrongdoing and they make apologies for it. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this particular discourse. This is chapter 23, The Perfectly Enlightened One Taught Monks to Eat at a Single Session. Okay, it looks like Mayu Lee has a question here. Does the time of that one meal or two meals per day matters when it was eaten? So during the lifetime of the Buddha, he would have students eat prior to midday, which we would consider to be noon. And the reason why is that, again, it takes the mind away from making the decision of when to eat. So this way it helps you to eliminate any central desire or central pleasure. Because if at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, if you had a conversation where you started experiencing anger or sadness or frustration, you wouldn't be able to eat because you're practicing this precept of not eating after midday. So by eating in the morning like this, it gives you the strength and energy that you need, but then it takes the mind out of the decision-making process of when to eat. So you could eat one or two meals a day if you like prior to noon. This is something that some people do, but typically as a household practitioner, you're going to need more food than that. You just need to be sure you're eating in moderation, like maybe smaller portions, and you're not meeting based on emotion. If you see that you're frustrated or sad or irritated and you're turning to food in order to get some kind of pleasant feelings, then you can observe that about the mind with your mindfulness and not allow the mind to do that. If you're having challenges doing that, you might decide to set up something like this where you only eat at specific time, you know, before midday, and just one or two meals per day. This could be helpful. Okay. All right. I'm not seeing any other questions anywhere. So let's go to chapter 24. Chapter 24, this one's titled, The Noble Disciples Will Not Transgress the Training Guidelines, Even for Life's Sake. Just as, student, the great ocean is stable and does not overflow its boundaries, so too, when I have prescribed a training guideline for the disciples, they will not do wrong even for life's sake. This is the second astounding and amazing quality that the monks see in these teachings and discipline, because of which they are pleased in it. Here quoted only one of eight astounding and amazing qualities that the monks see in these teachings and discipline. So the Buddha has this discourse that's longer, and he explains all the different things that are astounding or amazing qualities about the teachings that he's sharing. And this is just one of those. What he's sharing is that if you've learned the teachings and you've reflected on them and independently verified them and know that they're true, and you're starting to practice those teachings and you see the improvement to the condition of your mind, he's saying you wouldn't stop practicing these teachings even if it was a matter of life or death. If it was a matter of life or death, you still wouldn't stop practicing the teachings because you know that any kind of harm that you're causing, this harm is only going to come back to you. So you would accept death over not practicing these teachings, is what he's sharing. So let me know what questions you guys have here. Again, you can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, and I will answer any questions that you have. All right, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. Just a short little chapter here. Now we're moving into chapter 25. This one is titled Four Defilements of Aesthetics in Brahmins. So too, monks, there are four defilements of aesthetics in Brahmins, because of which some aesthetics in Brahmins do not shine, blaze, and radiate. What four? One, there are some aesthetics in Brahmins who drink liquor and wine, and do not refrain from drinking liquor and wine, ingest substances that cause heedlessness. This is the first defilement of aesthetics in Brahmins, because of which some aesthetics in Brahmins do not shine, blaze, and radiate. 2. There are some aesthetics in Brahmins who indulge in sexual intercourse and do not refrain from sexual intercourse. This is the second defilement of aesthetics in Brahmins, because of which some aesthetics in Brahmins do not shine, blaze, and radiate. 3. There are some aesthetics in Brahmins who accept gold and silver and do not refrain from receiving gold and silver. This is the third defilement of aesthetics in Brahmins, because of which some aesthetics in Brahmins do not shine, blaze, and radiate. 4. There are some aesthetics in Brahmins who earn their living by wrong livelihood and do not refrain from wrong livelihood. This is the fourth defilement of aesthetics in Brahmins, because of which some aesthetics in Brahmins do not shine, blaze, and radiate. These are the four defilements of aesthetics in Brahmins, because of which some aesthetics in Brahmins do not shine, blaze, and radiate. Okay, what the Buddha is talking about here is what are the reasons why people don't get to enlightenment? This shine, blaze, and radiate, that's what the mind experiences as you're getting closer and closer to enlightenment and you actually are enlightened, that the mind becomes bright and it's very radiant, right? That you're not experiencing the dullness, the lethargic, the exhaustion, the tiredness that you experience in the unenlightened state. Because when you're carrying around these pollutions in the mind, you can become very exhausted, right? So the Buddha is shining and blazing and radiating, right? His mind is radiating because he's not carrying around these pollutions. And he's giving examples of why other aesthetics and Brahmins, these are people who are into spiritual development, he's explaining why they're not getting to enlightenment and why they're not shining, blazing, and radiating. Because during the lifetime of the Buddha, there were many different teachers who were teaching. Just like now, there's many different teachers who are teaching. And each individual teacher was claiming that it was their teachings that lead to enlightenment. But the Buddha knew that it was his teachings that led to enlightenment. But other people were studying with other teachers. Now, you might think that if a Buddha was in existence, everybody would want to study with that Buddha. Everybody would be interested in doing that, right? But there's no outward characteristic of identifying that a Buddha is a Buddha. So it's not like the ear or the nose is turned a particular way, and now everybody knows that that person's a Buddha and everybody's gonna come study with that Buddha. It's also not like a Buddha goes around performing a bunch of miracles to convince people that they are a Buddha, because people not knowing that you're a Buddha is actually very helpful, because then the individual who's a Buddha can observe the quality of their student's mind and provide teachings to them that's gonna help them to be able to get to enlightenment. Whereas if everybody knew who the Buddha was, they'd probably be on their best behavior around that person, and they wouldn't be able to see the natural state of the person's mind and then be able to help their students to get to enlightenment. So there are other aesthetics and other Brahmin, these are spiritual people, who are studying different things from different people, and they weren't necessarily teaching the same things that the Buddha was teaching. So here he's sharing that if you're drinking liquor and wine, which was essentially the main intoxicant during that time, but nowadays we can look at all the different substances that cause heedlessness any of those are going to hinder you from being able to shine, blaze, and radiate or get to this enlightened mind. Indulging in sexual intercourse. You can get to the second stage of enlightenment and still be maintaining a sexual relationship, but in order to get to the third and then the fourth stage of enlightenment, you would need to eliminate sexual intercourse. Because if you've ever gone a period of time where you haven't had sexual intercourse, you notice that your mind became agitated or frustrated or irritated or annoyed during that time. And that's because of the craving or the desire for sexual intercourse. And when you get it, you get pleasant feelings. And when you don't get it, you get painful feelings. And you get frustrated and agitated and annoyed. So as long as you have a desire for sexual intercourse in your mind, you're going to still experience agitation and annoyance. And you're not going to be able to experience the permanent peace and joy of enlightenment. But you can get to that second stage of enlightenment doing all the other work on the path to enlightenment and perhaps hanging out there at the second stage of enlightenment for a period of time. And then whenever you're ready, whenever your partner's ready, you guys can decide that you're going to move on from there, because maybe you've been there, done that, and experienced enough sexual intercourse, and you're choosing to move towards this peace and joy, because you'll start noticing more and more peace and joy as you're doing all this work on the path to enlightenment. And that really is more beneficial, and you'll start appreciating the qualities of that peace and joy even more than the sex. As much as we might enjoy sex in the unenlightened state, there's something that's actually much better than sex that you haven't necessarily experienced yet, which is the enlightened mind. And as you start seeing more and more of those qualities of enlightenment shining through, you might kind of look at this temporary pleasantness that you experience with sexual intercourse and realize that, hey, those couple of hours or those couple of days of experiencing those feelings is nothing compared to this peace and joy that you experience in the enlightened mental state as those qualities are starting to shine through more and more. So you will ultimately most likely decide to let go of that sexual intercourse as you're experiencing more and more of the peace and joy. So here he's explaining that there are certain aesthetics and Brahmins who are having sexual intercourse, and this is the reason why they're not experiencing enlightenment. And then he's talking about receiving gold and silver, because an aesthetic or a Brahmin or a teacher or ordained practitioner, we accept offerings in order to sustain our life. During the lifetime of the Buddha, he accepted food, water, clothing, shelter, and medical care. He would ultimately live with his students side by side. They would invite him into their home. He would stay there for a number of days or weeks or even a few months, and he would share teachings with them as they would request teachings. So everything he needed was provided for him right there. So he didn't need gold or silver. He didn't need any kind of wealth whatsoever, because there was always somebody around to be able to provide him what he needed. Nowadays, we do accept financial support, and this is based on the way that society functions now. What the Buddha was doing by not accepting gold and silver was ensuring that him and his students' minds weren't attached to any kind of wealth or money, and they weren't craving that. Nowadays, that we do accept a bit of financial support, we need this in order to purchase things like socks or food or a toothbrush or toothpaste, or to travel on a bus or a plane or something like this, or purchase clothing. So financial support is needed, but you still need to ensure that you're not craving or desiring or attached to any kind of money, not only as a ordained practitioner or a teacher, but even as a household practitioner to be able to get to enlightenment, you would need to eliminate any attachment to money. Where right now, if your bank account is a certain balance, you might actually get happy or excited. But then if your bank account balance drops, you might be sad or frustrated or irritated or annoyed. So you need to get to the point where you're not basing your inner feelings on the amount of money or the amount of wealth that you have, because your mind's just gonna go up and down and up and down. So during the lifetime of the Buddha, they didn't receive any gold and silver, at least his students. But nowadays we do accept financial support because of the way the world is. There isn't a student there with a teacher or an ordained practitioner every single time they need something. So we accept financial support in order to help us to be able to share the teachings and provide the life essentials that we need in order to sustain our life. And you can still do that and still be shining and blazing and radiating if you don't have a craving, desire, attachment holding on to the money. Then there's number four here, where the Buddha talks about aesthetics and Brahmins who live by wrong livelihood. With household practitioners, he taught any kind of livelihood that's going to cause harm to other beings, that you should refrain from this, because anytime you sustain your life off of causing harm to others, this harm is going to come back to you. So as a household practitioner, he teaches to not sustain your life based in weapons, living beings, meat, substances that cause heedlessness and poisons. And you can independently reflect on these and see that it's true that if you did any of these things, that it would cause harm to other beings and this harm will come back to you. And then he has deeper teachings on right livelihood for household practitioners. But for aesthetics, he has even deeper teachings on wrong livelihood. So as an ordained practitioner, as a teacher, somebody who's aspiring to share these teachings with others, they would need to look at that much closer than just what the Buddha shares for household practitioners, because there's various things like palm reading, fortune telling, tattooing, things like this, that would be very unwise for someone who's teaching, either as an ordained practitioner, as a household practitioner who's teaching, to practice any of those things, because it's going to hinder you from being able to share these teachings in a way that's going to be helpful for the community that you're sharing the teachings with. So let me know if you guys have questions on this. This is chapter 25, Four Defilements of Aesthetics and Brahmins. All right, I'm not seeing any questions here. So we'll move on to chapter 26. Here you can see all the various reflections that I'm sharing with you to help you. Here, chapter 26, this one's titled Unwholesome Habits. What are unwholesome habits? They are unwholesome bodily actions, unwholesome verbal actions, and evil unwholesome livelihood. These are called unwholesome habits. And what do these unwholesome habits originate from? Their origin is stated. They should be said to originate from the mind. What mind? Though mind is multiple, varied, and of different aspects, there is mind affected by craving or greed, by anger or hatred, and by ignorance or delusion, unknowing of true reality. Unwholesome habits originate from this. And where do these unwholesome habits cease without remainder? Their elimination is stated. Here, a monk abandons bodily misconduct and develops wholesome bodily conduct. He abandons verbal misconduct and develops wholesome verbal conduct. He abandons mental misconduct and develops wholesome mental conduct. He abandons wrong livelihood and gains a living by right livelihood. It is here that unwholesome habits cease without remainder. And how practicing does he practice the way to the elimination of unwholesome habits? Here, a monk awakens enthusiasm for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states, and he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. He awakens enthusiasm for the abandoning of arisen, evil, unwholesome states. He awakens enthusiasm for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. He awakens enthusiasm for the continuation, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase, and fulfillment by development of arisen, wholesome states. And he makes effort, arouses energy, and exerts his mind and strives. One so practicing practices the way to the elimination of unwholesome habits. So here the Buddha is explaining what is the root cause of any unwholesome habits that you might have in the unenlightened state. So first he describes what an unwholesome habit is, which is unwholesome bodily, verbal, or actions, or this evil, unwholesome livelihood. Then it's like, okay, well, where do these things originate from? Well, they originate from the mind. The mind is the one who's deciding to do unwholesome bodily, verbal conduct, or take a livelihood that is going to cause harm to others. It's the mind that is making these choices. And then, what is the mind? Well, the mind is affected by these three poisons, or these three unwholesome roots, or these three fires of craving, anger, and ignorance, or the unknowing of true reality. This is where unwholesome habits originate from. Anything unwholesome that you do is coming from these unwholesome roots of craving, anger, and ignorance. And I talk about these at different times in the various resources that I share in the various classes. So now the next question is, well, where do these unwholesome habits eliminate? Where do you eliminate them, or where do they cease without remainder? Well, they eliminate by abandoning this unwholesome bodily conduct, verbal conduct, and right livelihood. You need to eliminate that from your practice, because as you're performing unwholesome bodily, verbal, and mental conduct and practicing a wrong livelihood, you're going to experience harm coming back to you. So it would be wise to eliminate this from your practice. And you're going to need to train your mind in order to do that, because that's where these decisions are being made to be able to function in this wholesome way, where you can experience nothing but wholesome results. Well, then the question is, well, how do you practice this? How do you get to the elimination of these unwholesome habits? Well, then the Buddha talks about right effort from the Eightfold Path, that you need this effort and enthusiasm to prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome mental states, and to eliminate unwholesome mental states that are in the mind, and to arise wholesome mental states to come into the mind. And then any wholesome mental states that are currently in the mind, that you support them, encourage them, and don't allow them to fade. So this is how one would get to the point where they're eliminating unwholesome habits, and you're making wise decisions about your bodily, verbal, and mental conduct in your livelihood, so that now, as you're making wise decisions, there's only wholesome results coming back to you. You're going to need to apply the effort to first learn the wisdom, but then to practice it by applying effort and energy to do so. So let me know what questions you guys have here. This is chapter 26, Unwholesome Habits. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So we'll move to the next chapter, which is chapter 27. This one is titled, Words Which Should Be Studied, Learned, and Investigated in the Foremost Assembly. And what is the assembly trained in investigation, not in conceited talk? Here, in this kind of assembly, when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by their disciples, the monks are not interested to listen to them, do not lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They do not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, the monks are interested to listen to them, lend an ear to them, and apply their minds to understand them. They think those teachings should be studied and learned. And having learned those teachings, they question each other about them and investigate them thoroughly, asking, how is this? What is the meaning of this? They disclose to others what is obscure and clarify what is unclear and dispel their confusion about numerous misunderstandings. This is called the assembly trained in investigation, not in conceited talk. And what is the assembly trained in conceited talk? Not in investigation. Here, in this kind of assembly, when those discourses are being spoken by the Tathagata, are being recited that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, the monks are not interested to listen to them, do not lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They do not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by their disciples, they are interested to listen to them, lend an ear to them, and apply their minds to understand them. They think those teachings should be studied and learned, and having learned those teachings, they do not question each other about them or investigate them thoroughly, asking, how is this? What is the meaning of this? They do not disclose to others what is obscure and clarify what is unclear or dispel their confusion about numerous misunderstandings. This is called the assembly trained in conceited talk, not in investigation. These monks are the two kinds of assemblies. Of these two kinds of assemblies, the assembly trained in investigation, not in conceited talk, is foremost. So here what he's talking about is that studying his teachings and investigating them and examining them and discussing them with each other, this is what's going to lead to enlightenment. And this is a community of people who are trained to investigate the teachings, not in this arrogant, conceited talk, not in this boastful talk. But there's some communities, even during the lifetime of the Buddha and now as well, that are more interested in having words that are beautiful and poetry, and they just are easy on the ears. And because they're easy on the ears, then people are interested in listening to those, right? And this is an assembly that's trained in conceited talk, not an investigation. That these aren't the true teachings that lead to enlightenment, but it just sounds beautiful, words and phrases. People are listening to it because it's easy on their ears, where if you learn the teachings of the Buddha, it's a challenge. It can be a real challenge to step up to understanding what it is that he really has to share with you, and then to integrate that into your life practice. So if you're in a community that is training you to investigate teachings, not just talk in arrogant, boastful ways, that's what the type of community that the Buddha is sharing that would be wise to be part of, because that's what's going to help you get to enlightenment. If you're just listening to mere poetry and conceited talk and you're not investigating the teachings, this isn't going to actually lead to your enlightenment. So here, this is why it's important to learn and study the teachings of the Buddha, original words that he actually shared, because while it's challenging for you and it's not easy on the ears, it is what's going to lead to your enlightenment. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this particular teaching. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, and I'll be able to see that and answer your questions. Okay, it looks like Mayuli has a question. Before discovering the words of the Buddha, I was listening and learning from various spiritual leaders, but now I only learn from the words of the Buddha. Is this what the Buddha means, not to lend an ear? Yes, that's what he's talking about. That if you understand that in situations where people are just speaking beautiful words and poetry, okay, you know, something that people do, but this is conceited talk. It's not actually investigating teachings that are going to really lead to enlightenment. But now, if you're truly interested in getting to enlightenment, you can study his words and study his teachings. And while it's challenging at times, this is what's going to actually lead to real growth and real development. And you've seen that too, Mayuli, because you've shared that with me. So yeah, that's what he's sharing, is that studying those particular teachings is what's going to lead to the development of your mind. Okay, I'm just looking through the rest of what Mayuli is saying here. Okay, those were your past questions. Okay, all right, so I don't see any other questions anywhere. So let's go to the next chapter, which is chapter 28. Here, this one's titled, Why Every Practitioner Should Study the Tathagata's Words. This is kind of a continuation of what we were studying in the previous chapter. And there's individual sections here that I might pause after each one and help you to understand. This one is titled, Words Which Should Be Studied, Learned, and Investigated in the Foremost Assembly. Here, in this kind of assembly, when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by their disciples, the monks do not want to listen to them, do not lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They do not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, the monks want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, and apply their minds to understand them. They think those teachings should be studied and learned. And having learned those teachings, they question each other about them and investigate them thoroughly, asking, how is this? What is the meaning of this? They disclose to others what is obscure and clarify what is unclear and dispel their confusion about numerous misunderstandings. This is called the assembly trained in investigation, not in conceited talk. So this is what the Buddha is guiding you to do. And this is what we just studied in the previous chapter. And now here's the next one. Words that should be studied and mastered. This is the simile of the drum peg. Monks, once in the past, the Dasarathas had a kettle drum called the summoner. When the summoner became cracked, they inserted another peg. Eventually, the time came when the summoner's original drumhead had disappeared and only a collection of pegs remained. So too, the same thing will happen with the monks in the future. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, dealing with emptiness are being recited, they will not be eager to listen to them, nor lend an ear to them, nor apply their minds to understand them, and they will not think those teachings should be studied and mastered. But when those discourses that are mere poetry composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by their disciples, are being recited, they will be eager to listen to them, will lend an ear to them, will apply their minds to understand them, and they will think those teachings should be studied and mastered. In this way, monks, those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, dealing with emptiness, will disappear. Therefore, monks, you should train yourselves thus. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, dealing with emptiness, are being recited, we will be eager to listen to them, we'll lend an ear to them, we'll apply our minds to understand them, and we will think those teachings should be studied and mastered. Thus should you train yourselves. So the Buddha is giving this analogy of a drum, that this drum made out of wood, that whenever it's having problems, they would just put another peg and another peg and another peg and another peg. And eventually, this drum head doesn't have anything left of the original drum. And that's what he's saying is going to occur to his teachings. And that's exactly what did occur. Over the last 2,500 years, he's here predicting 2,500 years ago that his teachings would disappear. He knew this, that slowly but surely, people would move away from his teachings. And now we're at this low point in his teachings, dating in 2017, and then now since that time, the teachings are slowly starting to come back into the world again, where somebody can now learn the original words of the Buddha. And he's saying, okay, when his teachings are in existence, he's encouraging his students to now learn them, because that's what's going to actually lead to enlightenment. Because he was saying, in the future, my teachings aren't going to exist, they're going to disappear. And then he's saying, now while they're here and they're bright and they're radiant and they're shining in the world, be sure to learn these particular teachings. So we saw this exact disappearance that the Buddha is describing, and now there's an effort to restore the teachings so that more and more people can understand them and be able to get to enlightenment. Then this next one is helping you to see why it's important to learn the original teachings of the Buddha. Words from singleness of mind. He's talking to a student. The Tathagata teaches the teachings to others only to give them knowledge. When the talk is finished, then I steady my mind internally, quieten it, bring it to singleness, and concentrate it on that same sign of concentration as before, in which I constantly reside. So he's saying, okay, when I teach, I share the teachings, but then my mind is quieted and brought to singleness. But even when you're teaching, your mind is practicing singleness of mind. This is why a Buddha can speak so clear and very concise and very precise, because his mind is focused, concentrated, has clarity of mind and deep memory. And this is what you can experience too when you're learning the original words of the Buddha. You can focus on just those words and then setting aside any of the poetry that you might hear from various sources. Words that are just so, not otherwise. From the night he fully awakened, monks, until the night he attains final nibbana or final enlightenment, in this interval, whatever he speaks, talks of, and expounds, all that is just so, not otherwise. So what they're saying is that the Buddha delivered from the time that he got to enlightenment until the time that he died, he delivered the teachings of what it takes to get to enlightenment. And everything that he spoke, this was in order to help people get to enlightenment, right? This is what he's sharing. Words of immediately effective teachings. Good monks, so you have been guided by me with these teachings, which are visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting introspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. So here what he's saying is, come investigate my teachings. Come examine them. They're inviting you to come investigate them, right? His teachings aren't based in belief. It's just the opposite. It's like, come examine them. Because when you examine the teachings of the Buddha close enough and you penetrate them, you'll be able to see that they're true. And you'll know that this is what's going to lead to enlightenment. So by investigating his words, this is what's going to help you to be able to get to enlightenment. And he's inviting you to come examine and investigate his teachings. Words of the teachings and discipline, words to be resided with as one's own island, as one's own refuge. Ananda, it may be that you will think the teacher's instruction has ceased. Now we have no teacher. It should not be seen like this, Ananda, for what I have taught and explained to you as teachings and discipline will, at my passing, be your teacher. Those monks, Ananda, either now or after I am gone, who reside with themselves as their own island, with themselves as their own refuge, with no other refuge, who reside with the teachings as their island, with the teachings as their refuge, with no other refuge, it is these monks, Ananda, who will be for me greatest of those dedicated to the training. So here he's talking to one of his closest students, Ananda, that 3 months prior to the Buddha dying, he was letting people know that, hey, I'm going to die in 3 months. And his student, Ananda, was attached to him and was like pleading with him not to die. And the Buddha is saying, okay, look, at my passing, when I die, the teachings that I've explained to you, that will be your teacher. You shouldn't see it as if the instruction has ceased and that there is no teacher. Instead, the teachings that I've shared over the last 45 years, that's going to be your teacher. So he makes sure that they understand that. Then he says, anybody who resides with themselves in the teachings as their own refuge, this is what's going to lead to enlightenment. And what he means here by a refuge is as your protection, that you need to understand that you are on your own independent journey. You're not a follower. You're not someone who's just blindly following somebody to be able to get to enlightenment. You're an independent practitioner who's making your way to enlightenment. But of course, you're going to need guidance from a teacher. Only a Buddha is going to be able to get to enlightenment without a teacher. But what the Buddha is talking about here is don't conform to what society is doing, because there's so many unenlightened beings in the world. If you just conform to what other people are doing, you'd be killing and stealing, having sexual misconduct, you'd be lying, you'd be taking substances that cause heedlessness, you'd be using wrong speech and wrong action, practicing wrong livelihood. This is a lot of what's going on in the world. So instead, the Buddha is encouraging you not to conform to what society is doing, to not just follow along any teacher, but instead be your own independent practitioner using the teachings as your guide. And you're going to need a teacher to guide you. So the Buddha is not saying here that you don't need a teacher. He's saying that, hey, don't be a follower. Make sure you're viewing this as your own independent practitioner, and you use the teachings as your guide to be able to help you and guide you along. Because there's other teachings where the Buddha describes that it's important to have a teacher, and you've seen those if you've been in this program for any length of time. And then this last one here, this part of this chapter, words to be undertook as taught, not to be abolished. As long as the monks do not give instruction on anything that has not been taught, or abolish anything that has already been taught, but undertake and practice the training guidelines as they have been taught, only growth is to be predicted for them, not decline. So what the Buddha is saying here is that when he's sharing teachings, if you only share what he's actually shared and shared what he's teaching, and you don't abolish anything that he taught, meaning eliminate anything that he taught, then that's what's going to actually lead to your enlightenment. That if you try to modify the teachings of the Buddha, this is going to lead to your harm and to the harm of many, many, many people. He has another discourse where he talks about it in that particular way. But here, he's just kind of giving a little bit of a synopsis, a short version of that. But what he shares is that if you change his teachings, it's going to harm you and it's going to harm countless people, because it's the teachings that a Buddha discovers that is going to lead to enlightenment. When you start tweaking and changing and modifying a Buddha's teachings, this is going to cause harm to you and many countless people, and you're going to find that it's very difficult for you to ever get to enlightenment learning teachings that have been modified and adjusted. And that's why it's so important that you learn with the original words of the Buddha, that you don't listen to just mere poetry, because that's not going to lead to your enlightenment. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this chapter. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. This is chapter 28 of volume 12. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So now we'll move to chapter 29. This one is titled, Those Who Cause the Good Teachings to Disappear, First Discourse. Monks. Those monks who explain non-teachings as teachings are acting for the harm of many people, the unhappiness of many people, for the ruin, harm, and suffering of many people, of heavenly beings and human beings. These monks generate much unwholesome karma and cause these good teachings, wholesome teachings to disappear. Monks, those monks who explain teachings as non-teachings, monks, those who explain non-discipline as discipline. Monks, those who explain discipline as non-discipline. Monks, those monks who explain what has not been stated and spoken by the perfectly enlightened one as having been stated and spoken by him. Monks, those monks who explain what has been stated and spoken by the perfectly enlightened one as not having been stated and spoken by him. Monks, those monks who explain what has not been practiced by the perfectly enlightened one as having been practiced by him. Monks, those monks who explain what has been practiced by the perfectly enlightened one as having not been practiced by him. Monks, those monks who explain what has not been prescribed by the perfectly enlightened one as having been prescribed by him. Monks, those monks who explain what has not been prescribed by the perfectly enlightened one as not having been prescribed by him are acting for the harm of many people, for the unhappiness of many people, for the ruin, harm, and suffering of many people, of heavenly beings and human beings. These monks generate much unwholesome karma and cause these good teachings to disappear. So let me explain what the Buddha is talking about so far. I think you could probably glean that from what's been shared. He's saying this is what causes his teachings to disappear, because as you saw earlier, he knew that his teachings were going to disappear. And here he's explaining what is going to cause that. It's individuals who are explaining non-teachings as teachings, meaning teaching something that the Buddha didn't teach, and they're declaring that this is what the Buddha taught. And you'll see this all throughout the world. And by you not studying the original words of the Buddha, you wouldn't know whether those teachings are true or false, because you're just believing that this person who's sharing teachings and calling it the Buddhist teachings, you're just taking it on faith and belief that what they're teaching you is true, but you haven't necessarily investigated it yourself. So that's why you need to learn with the original words of the Buddha and investigate the teachings so that you can see what did the Buddha teach and what he didn't teach, because his teachings have gradually disappeared over time. And this is the reason why, is because people modified his teachings and they're explaining things that he actually didn't teach and he didn't practice and he didn't prescribe. Herein, Ananda, monks explain non-teachings as teachings and teachings as non-teachings. They explain non-discipline as discipline and discipline as non-discipline. They explain what has not been stated and spoken by the perfectly enlightened one as having been stated and spoken by him, and what has been stated and spoken by the perfectly enlightened one as having not been stated and spoken by him. They explain what has not been practiced by the perfectly enlightened one as having been practiced by him, and what has been practiced by the perfectly enlightened one as having not been practiced by him. They explain what has not been prescribed by the perfectly enlightened one as having been prescribed by him, and what has been prescribed by the perfectly enlightened one as having not been prescribed by him. On these 10 grounds, they withdraw and go apart. They perform legal acts separately and recite the training guidelines of these teachings separately. It is in this way, Ananda, that there is division in the community. But, Venerable Sir, when one causes division in a harmonious community, what does one generate? One generates evil lasting for an eon, Ananda. But, Venerable Sir, what is that evil lasting for an eon? One is tormented in hell for an eon, Ananda. One who causes division in the community is bound for misery, bound for hell, to reside there for an eon. Delighting in division, established in non-teachings, he falls away from security, from bondage, enlightenment. Having caused division in a harmonious community, he is tormented in hell for an eon. So here the Buddha is explaining the results of having changed his teachings and having caused division in the community and separating the community. He's explaining the results of that. So here, if you're studying the original teachings of the Buddha and you're not believing the teachings, but you're learning, reflecting, and practicing, you can ensure that you're not being misguided or misled by any of the teachings, because you're using the teachings in your own island, as the Buddha shared, that you're actively working towards growing and developing. Now, during the lifetime of the Buddha, all his teachings were oral. Nothing was written down during his lifetime. So it was very easy for people to modify an oral tradition, because unless the Buddha or somebody that was really skilled in his teachings was there to be able to point out that this is not the teachings, there was no paper document to go back to and verify. It was only the Buddha or somebody that was known to be practicing his teachings very closely. It wasn't until after his death that the technology to write things down made its way to that part of the world that they could then write the teachings down. And now we have these to be able to share with the entire world. So now we can independently verify through these books, but also these books and these discourses, you shouldn't believe them. You need to be able to learn, reflect, and practice independently verifying and seeing the truth for for yourself. And this is what's going to lead to your development of wisdom and your liberation of mind to experience enlightenment. So let me know if you guys have any questions here where the Buddha is explaining what causes his teachings to disappear. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So now the last chapter for today, which is chapter 30. This is actually just the opposite of the chapter that we just read, where he's teaching those who sustain the good teachings, the first discourse. So I'm not going to need to read all of this, but it's essentially just the opposite of what he was just explaining, is that he says, okay, those who sustain the good teachings, that they explain non-teachings as non-teachings, and they explain teachings as teachings. Non-discipline as non-discipline, and discipline as discipline. They understand the true teachings. And that's what the Buddha is basically getting to here, is that they're sharing the actual teachings. And then he gets down here that he says, one who basically produces harmony within a relation, within a community, that this individual has produced the divine merit, that they've created this harmony in a community. And then he talks about, okay, well, what's the result of that? And he describes that result of rebirth into the heavenly realm. But of course, your goal is to get to enlightenment in this life, right? That you're not interested in dividing up a community and separating people. An enlightened being would be interested in bringing people together and seeing people be harmonious, right? So oftentimes in the unenlightened state, we look at separating people and pushing people away. But in the enlightened mind, they're going to be interested in bringing people together and seeing people live harmoniously together. So let me know what questions you guys have on this chapter. It's very similar to the last one. So since you didn't have questions on the last one, you may not have questions on this one. But let me just give you guys the opportunity to ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So what I'll do then is just in class by reminding you next week, we're going to be studying the next 10 chapters. We're going to be studying volume 12, chapters 31 through 40. So if you'd like to read those ahead of time, because you have the words of the Buddha, you have the reference to go back to the original text if you'd like to, and you have the reflections from me to be able to help you. And you can be reading 10, 15, 20 minutes a day just to kind of gradually trickle the teachings into the mind. This is a great way to gradually learn the teachings and give the mind time to breathe and reflect on what it is that you've actually learned. And this will help you to more readily bring them into your life and integrate them into your life. So next week, that's what we're going to be doing in our Pali Canon and English study group. Tomorrow in the group learning program, we're going to be in volume 1, chapter 1. We're going to be starting from the very beginning of this book, and we're going to be going chapter by chapter each Sunday. Chapter 1 is titled Universal Teachings, Love, No Harm, and Good Morals. This is where you're going to learn about the teachings of Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Muslim teachings, and others, and how there's this commonality between all of these teachings, and that you can see that commonality. Rather than looking at dividing people up, and these people think this way, and these people think this way, and now we need to fight and argue about who's right and who's wrong, what I prefer to do is look at the commonalities between these teachings, because you'll see some common things and common themes that are actually going to help you in developing your life practice if you understand what those common themes are. So you can build on what it is that you've learned in the past. If you've learned Christian teachings or Muslim teachings or Hindu teachings or any other teachings, you can build on that by understanding this commonality between them. And then on Wednesday, we'll be in part 2 of our 4-part series on loving kindness meditation. So if you'd like to build up your loving kindness meditation practice, you can attend on Wednesday or watch the replay. All of these courses, classes, and retreats that I share, they're all live, but they're all being recorded too. So you can go back and watch them more than once, or if you miss a class, you can always watch it on our YouTube channel, on our podcast, or even on our Facebook group. It'll be in there as well. So thank you all for joining for today's class, and perhaps we'll see you guys in one of these future classes. Have a very wonderful and lovely rest of your day. We'll see you next time. Sawadee khrap.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings. A well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.